This is Audible.
These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. They are produced by the Teaching Company. The Great Courses cover a broad array of university-level disciplines. The lectures in each course are either 30 or 45 minutes long. By listening for less than an hour a day, you can finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalog or website and imagine how much you could learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the best college classrooms in the world. The lecturers are university professors carefully selected by the Teaching Company and its customers for intellectual distinction and teaching excellence. These lectures are titled The Story of Medieval England, From King Arthur to the Tudor Conquest. The lecturer is Professor Jennifer Paxton, professorial lecturer in history at Georgetown University and visiting assistant professor in history at the Catholic University of America. Professor Paxton earned her BA with honors from Yale University and was awarded a Mellon Fellowship in the Humanities to pursue her doctorate at Harvard University, which she earned in 1999. Professor Paxton's research focuses on England in the period between the reign of King Alfred and the late 12th century. She is particularly interested in the intersection of church and state and the representation of the past in historical texts. She has published articles in several scholarly volumes and journals, including the Haskins Society Journal and Anglo-Norman Studies. She is currently completing a book entitled Chronicle and Community in 12th Century England, which is under contract with Oxford University Press. In addition to her teaching responsibilities, Professor Paxton is past conference director for the Charles Homer Haskins Society, a scholarly society dedicated to the study of the Anglo-Norman realms in the Central Middle Ages. She lectures regularly on medieval history at the Foreign Service Institute in Arlington, Virginia, and has been invited to speak on British history at the Smithsonian Institution and the Shakespeare Theater in Washington, D.C. The course guidebook that comes with these lectures includes lecture guides, a timeline, a glossary, and a bibliography. To get the most out of this course, you may find it useful to review these materials before or after each lecture. Lecture 1. From Britannia to Britain.
Welcome to this course on medieval England. In this course, we're going to cover 1,000 years of history, roughly from the 5th century to 1485. It was quite a remarkable millennium. During these 1,000 years, the island of Britain saw enormous changes, and we're going to learn about those changes in this course. Let me give you a very quick preview of what happened. In the early 5th century, a relatively unimportant province of the Roman Empire in the far northwest of Europe named Britannia, or Britain, it was attacked by barbarians. Unfortunately, the Roman authorities had their hands full. So they essentially told the people of Britannia that they were on their own. And Britannia did indeed fall to these barbarian enemies, the Angles and the Saxons. These newcomers founded a network of kingdoms concentrated in the southern and eastern parts of the island, in what is now England. The remnants of the native population of Britain were pushed into the north and west of the island, into what is now Wales and Scotland. But in their turn, the Anglo-Saxons were invaded in the 9th century. Vikings from Scandinavia destroyed all the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms, except for Wessex in the southwest. Wessex was the springboard for an Anglo-Saxon revival. The Wessex dynasty reconquered the territory ruled by the Vikings, and this resulted in a unified kingdom for the people who became known as the English. Then, this English kingdom was, in its turn, conquered twice during the 11th century, first by the Danes, and then, famously, by the Normans in 1066. And for the next 4 centuries after the Norman conquest, England faced in 2 directions. It looked to the continent of Europe, especially France. France, for the English elite, was the source of high culture. And indeed, This contact with France had profound effects on English culture. But England also looked to the poorer parts of the island of Britain in the north and the west, and the English came to feel that these areas were naturally supposed to be subject to English domination. By the end of our period, England is no longer closely connected to France, but it has succeeded in dominating Wales and then Ireland. Under the Tudors, who take power in 1485, at the end of the dynastic struggle we know of as the War of the Roses, the English are poised to create one of the most successful nation-states in the history of the world. The drive to dominate the island of Britain that begins during the Middle Ages, it ends up being a kind of dress rehearsal for the British Empire, the empire on which the sun never set. We're going to spend the next 36 lectures telling the story of all of these transformations. And I want to start by saying a little bit about why I think it's a good idea to learn about medieval England. The first reason is quite simply that this is a great story. It's filled with dramatic events, the Battle of Hastings in 1066. William, Duke of Normandy, becomes William the Conqueror. The murder of Thomas Becket in Canterbury Cathedral in 1170. This creates the most famous martyr of the Middle Ages, and it provides the justification for one of the greatest works of English literature, the Canterbury Tales. The showdown between Yorkists and Lancastrians at Bosworth Field in 1485. The tyrant King Richard III supposedly calls in vain for a horse, and he loses both his kingdom and his life. So we'll tell all these stories in this course. But why these stories and not others? Does medieval England matter for any other reason besides the fact that it's full of exciting battles and colorful personalities? Well, I would argue strongly that it does, especially if you live in an English-speaking society. You don't even have to be a citizen of that society, and you certainly don't have to be of English descent in any sort of narrow genealogical sense. You don't have to be English to benefit from knowing about medieval England. Many countries, not just the United States, owe a profound debt to medieval England. Canada, Australia, New Zealand, for example. And in a different sense, so do the cultures of countries that were profoundly affected by English colonization. For example, India and Pakistan, many countries in Africa and the Caribbean. And I want to give you just a few examples of this debt to medieval England. What do we owe to medieval England? People often say American society is very litigious. We like to sue each other. And we also take a lot of pride in our legal rights. We're not shy about insisting on them, whether it's the right to bear arms or the right to free speech. Now, this focus on the law as something positive, something that gives power to the individual, this is a direct legacy of medieval England. Let's think of an example. In our society, if we have a disagreement with a neighbor, we can settle it in court. We can sue them, take them to court. We don't have to do it ourselves. We don't have to fight the person to settle the dispute. And that access to a means of dispute resolution in a public court, that's the product of many centuries of development during the Middle Ages. Now, what if you're on the other end of the problem? What if you are accused of a crime? The right to a criminal trial by one's peers. That was established during the struggle between King John and his barons that resulted in Magna Carta, the Great Charter, in 1215. So our modern legal system has very deep medieval English roots, and we simply can't understand why we have the rights that we do if we don't understand the context that they came from. Now, in addition, all of the political systems of the English-speaking countries around the world derive some of their most basic principles from developments during the Middle Ages in England. At the heart of all of these political systems is the principle of representative government. The people in society should have a voice in the decisions that their governments make. Specifically, they should be able to choose people from their own region to represent them in a national assembly. This principle was established during many years of bickering between English rulers and their barons. At the heart of these disputes was the need of the English kings to raise money. Mostly they wanted money to pay for more foreign wars, and the kings were not able to extort the money from their barons by force. They certainly tried, but they couldn't do it. so they had to ask for it. In the process of asking for money, they opened up scope for negotiation. And the result was Parliament. This is a body in which people can debate royal policy. They can approve royal taxes or not. Now, during the period we're studying in this course, the number of people who need to consent to taxation is very tiny. Only very wealthy men are deemed important enough for their opinions to count. We're not talking about mass democracy here, certainly. But the principle is established that the rule of kings in England is not arbitrary. There are limits, and as long as the Parliament controls the purse strings, kings have to tailor their policies to the opinions of their most important subjects, at least somewhat. And this need to consult their subjects takes on greater momentum over time. Whenever kings try to disregard these opinions, they get in trouble, and sometimes they lose their thrones and their lives as a result. Nowadays, our representatives, our elected representatives, they can refuse to support the policies of the executive if they so choose. And this is a direct result of these hard-fought battles between king and parliament during the Middle Ages in England. So our legal and political systems, they are really legacies of medieval England. Our ability to vote for our political representatives, our ability to rely on rights that are enshrined in our laws, these are due directly to developments in the period that we're going to study over the next 36 lectures. But on a very deep level, even when we're not doing anything directly related to the government, we're all heirs of medieval England. In a very basic way, all of us who speak English, whether it be as a native tongue or as a second language, we're all experiencing the distinctive history of England whenever we open our mouths, because English is a mongrel language. The very grammar and vocabulary of English shows evidence of the many invasions of English history. One of the first things to say about English is what it doesn't have in it. It doesn't have very much remnant of the British language that was spoken in England before the Angles and Saxons settled there. When they settled in the 5th century, they started to speak, they spoke their Germanic language that they brought with them, and they essentially replaced the language of the indigenous inhabitants, either because the British assimilated to the new dominant culture, or because all the British were simply killed or driven away. We're going to talk about that in another lecture. It's probably a mixture of both. But the history of the English language really begins at the beginning of our course in the 5th century with the Germanic language brought from Europe by the Angles and the Saxons. The next big transformation in the English language occurs at the time of the Viking invasions in the 9th century. At that time, large numbers of Scandinavians, mostly Danes, some Norse, settle in eastern and northern Britain, and their presence is significant enough to influence the structure of English. Think for a second about our English pronouns. We have a lot of pronouns that begin with a th, a this, they, there. All of those th pronouns, they all derive from Old Norse. Whenever we talk about other people in English, when we talk about them, we're speaking a little bit of Old Norse that the Vikings brought to Britain. Finally, of course, the greatest change in the history of the English language came about as the result of the Norman conquest of 1066. Until that period, English is a typical Germanic language with influences from another Germanic language, Old Norse. After the Norman conquest, English is profoundly influenced by French, the language of the conquerors. For several hundred years after the conquest, the language of elite society is French. And this is the case even though, within a very short time after the conquest, people have to learn French as a second language. It's an acquired language, but it has such prestige that they want to keep speaking it. As a result, French vocabulary permeates English. It gives English almost a second vocabulary. And to this day, we can often choose between a native Germanic word for an object and its French equivalent. For example, we can speak about clothes. Clothes is a nice old Germanic word, pretty general. But then you can use the French word garments. And there's a slight hint there of social elevation. Garments is a fancier word. You can tell that the French vocabulary comes from the elite, and the English vocabulary comes from everyone else. But the fact that English has this very extensive vocabulary comes from this massive borrowing of prestige words into English as a result of the conquest. It's one reason English is such an expressive language. We've got a lot of shades of meaning to choose from. So it's fascinating to think of how our very language bears the marks of medieval English history. But this is not the only cultural debt that we owe to medieval England, besides the language itself. There are all the stories that derive from this period. They still form a part of popular culture to this day. For example, the legends of King Arthur and of Robin Hood. They were developed during the Middle Ages in England, and they took distinctive forms that changed over time. And this is a process that is still going on. Each new generation reinvents Arthur and Robin Hood for itself. Now, in this course, we're going to follow these myths as they are born and as they are transformed by changing political and social conditions. The King Arthur of the 6th century is not the same as the King Arthur of the 12th century, who was not the same as the King Arthur of the 15th century, but he's still recognizably King Arthur. And this continuity, even in the face of very great change, that's one of the distinctive features of English culture. So this course is going to let us understand the roots of some of these cultural icons that still appear in our books, our films, our other media to this very day. So this period is full of exciting events. It'll help you understand your own society. Those are two very good reasons to study medieval England. But there is a third. I hope you'll find this course interesting because it talks not just about famous people like William the Conqueror and Joan of Arc. We're going to talk about them. But also about ordinary people and how they reacted to the tremendous changes of the period that we're describing. There are going to be plenty of kings and queens and nobles in this course. But we're not going to neglect the rest of society. We'll watch the mass of English men and women persevere through disasters like famine and plague. They're going to build a society that is ultimately going to spread its influence around the globe. So this is their story. And at specific points during the course, we'll be paying particular attention to what daily life was like for them. Now I just want to spend a few minutes talking about some of the themes that we're going to concentrate on as we tell this story. First, we're going to follow the process of creating a unified English state. The island of Britain had always been ethnically diverse. How do you make one country out of this? The arrival of migrants from the continent starting in the 5th century, this adds a new layer of complexity to this ethnic mix. And the new settlers are not by any means ethnically unified themselves. Only very slowly does a notion of Englishness develop that embraces all of these groups. So in this course, we're going to look at how English nationalism grows out of these very unpromising beginnings and how England ends up absorbing successive waves of invaders. You have Vikings coming in, you have French-speaking Normans coming in, and somehow they all end up as English. So we'll see how Englishness develops. We'll also see Englishness end up being contrasted with the Celtic other. Okay? Those people on the fringes of the areas that the Angles and Saxons settle, the Welsh and the Scots and later the Irish, they become the other against which the English define themselves. So English history in the Middle Ages is a story of the successful creation of a sense of nationhood. But that process is not a peaceful one. There's tremendous conflict. Different individuals are struggling to establish rulership over England. And this competition for power at the top, this is our second main theme. For many centuries, these struggles took place against a background of division. You have many small kingdoms competing for hegemony. But even after you get the creation of a more or less unified English kingdom in the 10th century, you still have violent conflict at the top. Kings in these early centuries only very rarely succeed to the throne without having to fight for it. It took centuries even to settle on the principle of peaceful dynastic succession. A son should follow his father as king. It took a long time to do that, and even afterwards, kings have to fear being deposed and replaced by their rivals. And kings often have a very complicated relationship with their noble followers. On the one hand, these supporters are the backbone of royal rule. Kings simply can't maintain their authority without them. On the other hand, These nobles could often be notoriously unreliable. Rebellion was common. A third theme of the course, very much related to the second, about power at the top. A third theme will be the tense relationship between kings and the nobility. We'll look at how the nature of noble rebellion changes over time. In the early period of our course, nobles are mostly rebelling against kings purely for selfish reasons. They want a better deal. In the later period, starting from the time of Magna Carta until 1215, nobles often, not always, but often have overtly political goals in mind when they rebel. We're starting to move toward a political nation. And this is by no means to say that there's no self-interest involved. There's always self-interest involved when nobles revolt. But it's not the only element. We start to see programmatic elements in these revolts. So we're going to be looking at a lot of rebellions in this course and watch how they change character. But one of the most famous medieval English rebellions was led not by the nobility, but by people at the bottom of the social hierarchy. And I'm talking here about the Peasants' Revolt of 1381. We'll see when we get to that point in the course that it's a bad name for the revolt. It's not really led by peasants. They're tradesmen, they're lower order clerics, that sort of people. But the fact is that they're relatively humble, but they managed to pull off a massive revolt, really the scariest moment for royal power in the whole of the Middle Ages. And that, I think, is proof of how much progress ordinary people have made during this period. So, the fourth theme in the course will be the changes in everyday life for people in England. We're going to see them absorb these political, religious, economic, and social developments, but we're also going to see them contribute to shaping these trends. The mass of ordinary men and women in England are a much bigger factor in English society at the end of our period than they are at the beginning. As I said, we're not talking about democracy, nothing close to it. But by 1485, the powerful cannot ignore the less powerful without serious risk of political turmoil. They have to care about the crowd. So those are the main themes that we're going to be following through the course. Now I'd like to say a word about terminology, specifically about geographical terminology. This course is going to deal mostly with the history of medieval England, and it's important to note that England is not synonymous with Britain, though the two are often used interchangeably. Britain is the island of which England forms a major part. Britain also includes Scotland and Wales, and as we'll see, the relationship between England and these other political entities is very complicated. The English begin to feel from very early in their history that they have a natural right to overlordship over the whole island of Britain. They set about establishing that overlordship. They're far more successful in our period in Wales than they are in Scotland. Wales is completely conquered by England in the late 13th century. We'll tell that story in a subsequent lecture. Scottish independence, however, is maintained, but only at the cost of fighting repeated wars with England. And the English really only fail to conquer Scotland because Scotland has a very powerful ally. They ally with France. But at various points in the history of the relationship between England and Scotland, it could have gone either way. Here I want to jump ahead of our period for just a few moments to explain a little bit more why I think this terminological confusion is important to talk about. As I said, during our period, Scotland maintains its independence. But in 1603, there's a dynastic accident that makes the Scottish king, King of England as well. James VI of Scotland inherits the throne of England because Elizabeth I dies without heirs, and King James of Scotland is her closest living relative. So this long-standing effort that England has engaged in throughout the period we're studying to dominate Scotland, it finally actually works out by accident because the Scottish monarchy, once they become kings of England as well, they transfer themselves wholesale down to London and they become English practically overnight. The Stuart monarchy loses its Scottish character entirely. This process is taken further in 1707 with the Act of Union. In the Act of Union, England and Scotland merged their parliaments. Up until that time, there were separate parliaments in England and Scotland, but now they have one parliament, They shared one monarch before, and now they have one parliament as well. After the Act of Union, the English begin a conscious attempt to create a British identity. And this is supposed to forge an overarching sense of belonging to some sort of greater political unit that includes the English and the Scottish and the Welsh. And they decide actually to reach back to the terminology of the Roman period. They use the terms Britain and British because that includes the whole island of Britain. And that's why in the government of the United Kingdom today, you almost never hear the term English. English is actually seen as sort of politically incorrect, because if you say English, you mean not the Scots, not the Welsh. You're excluding the residents of Northern Ireland. So there's a fear of causing offense if you are looking as if you're making English stand for British. And I have a funny example of how this fear can be taken to absurd extremes. I saw an ad a few years back. It advertised something called British muffins. British muffins. As if the term English muffins might be regarded as some sort of chauvinistic insult to the Welsh. Now, we're not going to worry about that sort of thing in this course. Nevertheless, we're going to use these terms England and Britain carefully. By Britain, we will usually mean the island of Britain in the geographical sense. There is no political entity Britain during our period. By England, we will mean the land under the control of the people who come to be known in the course of the Middle Ages as the English. But if I'm asking you to consider these terms as distinct concepts, I'd better define them a little bit more fully. Let's look, first of all, at what the island of Britain comprises. And I think the very best place to start is with a description of Britain. This would have been very familiar to most educated English readers during the Middle Ages. And this is the description that begins the famous work of the 8th century English monk, the Venerable Bede. He wrote a work called The Ecclesiastical History of the English People. And this is what Bede says about the island of Britain. He says, Britain is an island in the ocean, lying towards the northwest at a considerable distance from the coasts of Germany, Gaul, and Spain, which together form the greater part of Europe. It extends 800 miles northwards and is 200 in breadth. Now, that's actually pretty accurate, especially for someone using the map-making techniques available in the Middle Ages. And Bede goes on. He describes the natural resources of the island. Britain is rich in grain and timber. It has good pasturage for cattle and draft animals, and vines are cultivated in various localities. There are many land and seabirds of various species, and it is well known for its plentiful springs and rivers abounding in fish. So what is Bede driving at here? What are we supposed to take away from this description of the island of Britain? First of all, he's trying to get across the point that Britain is a fertile island. It's well watered by rivers. That's extremely important, both for agriculture and for trade. It's also heavily forested at the time that Bede is writing. Of course, later on, most of these forests in Britain are going to be cut down for timber and fuel. Now, these geographical facts are very important for English history. First, the fertile soil and the mild climate, especially in the south and the east. This means the inhabitants of Britain are going to suffer less from bad harvests than people on the continent are. This is not to say that there's never famine in Britain. There certainly is. But famines in Britain tend to be less severe, and they don't last as long as they do in the rest of Europe. So Britain has a big advantage just from its geography. Now, I just want to give you a quick side note about something that Bede mentions. He mentions vines growing in Britain. Britain is on the margin of the area where grapes can be cultivated. At times when the climate is particularly warm, such as the period when Bede was writing, wine has been produced in Britain. Then during most of the rest of the Middle Ages, you couldn't produce wine in Britain. It's an interesting sign of the times that grapes are growing in Britain again today. Now, another good thing about Britain's river systems is that they make internal trade relatively easy, especially, again, in the south and the east. Britain has lots of navigable rivers. The most famous one, of course, is the Thames that runs through London. And these rivers make it fairly easy to travel within Britain and to transport goods. And this is, after all, a period when water travel is a lot easier and a lot cheaper than travel by land. Britain's forests are also a very great natural resource. Forests were the source of timber for building, wood for fuel, but there's a lot of other things that you can get from a forest as well. Lots of kinds of food, wild plants. People would hunt game for food, herbs for medicine, wicker for basket making. All sorts of things come out of the forest. And we're going to see that control of the forests actually becomes a real bone of contention between English kings and their subjects, simply because we're talking about a very lucrative resource. So, if we sum all this up, what do we get from Bede? Britain is very well endowed with natural resources. It has a good climate. It has nice rivers. It has forests. Everything you need. But there are some important facts about British geography Bede doesn't mention, and they can help explain something very important about the island of Britain. Why does it end up having three countries in it, not one? Why do you have England, Wales, and Scotland? Britain is broadly divided into two zones, a zone in the southeast and a zone in the northwest. In the southeast, you have a more fertile zone. You have low-lying lands. In the northwest, you have a rockier zone. It's more mountainous. So the south and the east, that has terrain that is much more suited to arable farming, growing crops in fields. In the north and the west, it's much more suited to grazing animals, especially sheep. Now, this division into agricultural zones, it has important consequences that would influence settlement patterns and political developments for the whole of the period covered by this course and beyond. When the Angles and Saxons settle in the island of Britain in the 5th century, they're strong enough to claim the best agricultural land in the south and the east. This is the land that can support high densities of population. And you set up, thus, a demographic imbalance between the lands settled by the English and the lands that the descendants of the British were pushed back to in Wales and the southwest and the northwest. It's also a lot easier to create a unified political entity in the south and the east. It's not easy, we're going to see that, but it's easier. Communications are easier in the broad, well-watered plains of the southeast. In the rocky north and west, it's simply harder to get around, harder to do what you need to do to keep communications going. It's simply easier to hold power over an area when you can get around easily and make your presence felt. So this basic geographical fact about Britain, it goes a long way to explaining why it's the English who end up dominating the island, but it also explains why the English never completely assimilate the Welsh and the Scots either. And incidentally, this imbalance of power is still seen as something of a problem in modern British politics today. British politicians worry out loud a lot about the fact that you have opportunity and wealth disproportionately concentrated in the south and the east of the country. If anything, this disparity is much greater in the Middle Ages than it is today. So this is the geographical background. We have a lowland zone in the south and east. It's more fertile. It's richer. We have a highland zone in the north and the west. It tends to be poorer, more focused on pastoral farming, raising livestock. It can support a much smaller population. Broadly speaking, and here I'm generalizing, this is the distinction people are referring to when they talk about the contrast between England and the Celtic fringe. But there are even parts of Britain settled by the English that are considered remote. The far north and west of what becomes England share some of these same geographical characteristics as the Celtic areas. There's always a sense that life in the border areas, the regions where English and Celtic settlement bump up against each other, life there is a little rougher, it's a little less advanced than in the areas closer to the political center of things in the southeast. And we'll see at many points in this course, political developments on the borders of England can threaten the stability of the center. For example, the Norman Conquest. It ends up being indirectly touched off by a revolt in the remote northern English province of Northumbria. I'll explain that in a subsequent lecture. English history has always turned partly on this culture clash between the core and the periphery of the kingdom. So, let's begin this remarkable story of the people who have inhabited the island of Britain. In the next lecture, we'll look at Roman Britain, and we'll see what the Angles and Saxons are going to encounter when they arrive on the shores of Britain in the 5th century to start the long process of creating England.
Lecture 2, Roman Britain and the Origins of King Arthur.
Welcome back. Last time, I introduced the course, and I talked about the many changes that England would experience in the course of the time that we're going to be covering in this course, over the 1,000 years between the 5th century and 1485. Today, we're going to look at one of those transformations, the end of Roman occupation in Britain and the arrival of the people who are going to be known as the English. Along the way, we're going to meet Arthur. So we're going to see that we can't be sure whether we should call him King Arthur or not. So let's begin by very briefly talking about how the Romans got to Britain and then how they left. In all, the Romans held Britain for about 4 centuries. The first time the Romans set foot in Britain was in 55 BC under Julius Caesar. Caesar led an expedition to Britain in that year, but it wasn't very successful. So he came back the next year with a greater number of soldiers, and he did manage to get some local British tribes to promise submission to Rome. And then Caesar left, and really there isn't much more to it than that. It's just Caesar's little British adventure, and mostly it's just an offshoot of the campaign that he was waging in Gaul. This is his famous campaign. This is the one that leads him to write that all Gaul is divided into 3 parts. This is a sentence that many students of Latin have had to suffer through. Caesar really is only drawn to Britain because he thinks some of the tribes there might be giving aid and comfort to his enemies in Gaul, because some of the British tribes may in fact have had family connections to Gaul. So Caesar doesn't want them to be helping his enemies in Gaul. There's one other possible reason. He may have heard rather exaggerated stories about the potential of riches being found in Britain. Maybe there's lots of gold and silver there. Of course, it swiftly turns out not to be true that there's gold and silver in great abundance in Britain, and that may be one reason why Caesar doesn't really bother to put more of an effort into conquering Britain. But the most important reason that he doesn't stick around in Britain is that, really, Gaul is all he can handle. And as soon as he subdues Gaul, he's back to Rome to start a civil war. So, this little British escapade really is Caesar's own project. It's part of his private effort to secure riches and fame. It doesn't really go anywhere. It's not really official Roman policy at all. So nothing much happens between Rome and Britain for about a century. And in that century, of course, a lot changes for Rome. In between, the Roman Republic falls, largely due to Caesar's own actions, and Rome is now led by an emperor. The imperial administration grows much more elaborate. And the second time Rome encounters Britain, it's going to be much more of an official enterprise. It all starts in 43 AD under the emperor Claudius. Claudius decides that he wants some sort of military triumph that he can boast about, and Britain is one of the last feasible places that the Romans can conquer. But unlike Julius Caesar, Claudius is not a general. So he has his soldiers plan the campaign and carry it out. They send a much larger number of men than Julius Caesar had had. Claudius basically just shows up at the end to take the credit. This time, though, the Romans were planning to stay. They make arrangements to collect tribute from a lot of the British tribes, particularly in the south and the east. And over the course of the next 20 years or so, they establish legions at several important strongholds throughout Britain, including Londinium, which of course becomes London. And the other very important center is Eboracum. Eboracum becomes York. There were many other fortified sites throughout the country. And of course, the Romans do what they always do. They connect them to each other with their famous Roman roads. A lot of times, these roads are based on existing trackways, things that the native British have already built. But the big contribution of the Romans is, of course, that they pave the roads, and often they make them straighter. This is helpful for the armies if they have to march a long distance. And some of these roads that the Romans built are still actually quite important in English life today. The Roman engineers are so good, later on, when engineers need to plan modern motorways, they often just use the same routes. They use the routes of the Roman roads. For example, a very famous Roman road became known later on as Watling Street. It was a great road that led northwest from Dover to London, and then from London, continuing northwest to Wroxeter. And these two stretches of road are today the A2 and A5 motorways. So many English workers today can thank the Romans for their daily commute. So the Romans are busily turning Britain into a typical Roman province. But there was quite a serious bump in the road along the way, because not everyone in Britain is pleased with the way things are going under Roman rule. Some tribes have entered into agreements with the Romans, but not all of these arrangements work smoothly. This is particularly the case for a tribe in the east of England, the Iceni. They broke out in a terrifying rebellion in 60 AD, and this rebellion came very close to sweeping the Romans out of Britain altogether. What happened is this. The king of the Iceni, a guy named Prasutagus, dies without any sons, and the Roman authorities decide to incorporate the kingdom into the administration of the province. Apparently, some of the local Roman officials, however, they overreach themselves. They're sent to carry out the annexation, but things get out of hand. And they end up flogging the king's widow, Queen Boudica, and raping her two daughters. Now, Boudica is naturally not very happy about this, and she rises in revolt. And she manages to carry a lot of the other British tribes into revolt with her. And the British who revolt seem determined to erase all signs of Roman rule in Britain. Wherever they find Romans, they kill them. Wherever they come upon Roman settlements, they burn them. They even manage to burn the biggest settlement, Londinium. And to this day, if you go down below the level of the street, down to the level of Roman occupation, you will find a layer of ash that is still left over from the huge fire that raged at the time of Boudica's revolt. Eventually, though, the Romans do overpower Queen Boudica. She's captured and killed, and the Romans reestablish control of the southern part of the island. But it had been a very close-run thing. The Roman authorities were clearly spooked, and one of the decisions that they made over the next couple of decades was that they're going to concentrate their efforts in Britain in the south and the east, where they've had the most success thus far. So under Emperor Hadrian, in the early 2nd century, the Romans build a wall clear across what is now northern England. This is to mark off the territory that they're prepared to defend. To the south of the wall is civilized territory. To the north, there are barbarians. There are tribes such as the Picts. Picts comes from the Latin word for painted people. They're people who paint themselves blue and they fight naked. These are people that the Romans are just as happy not to mess with. And they find out why they shouldn't mess with the Picts when they try to build a wall a little further north. They build a wall called the Antonine Wall a few decades after Hadrian's Wall. And that one proves to be too far north, and the Romans basically abandon it. And Hadrian's Wall becomes the boundary of the Roman Empire. The word in Latin is limes. That's the boundary. And that's actually where we get our word limit from. So already Britain is divided at the time of Roman rule into a larger southern portion. This is what the Romans are willing to defend. And a smaller northern portion that they're not interested in defending. They're going to leave that alone. But even in the south, the colonized area, the Roman province of Britain falls into two broad zones, and these zones roughly follow the topographical divisions that I outlined in the last lecture. First, there's the southern and eastern part of the province. This is the area with the broad plains, with the fertile agricultural land. It's the easiest for the Romans to conquer. And by the 2nd century, there are about 40 major urban centers established in this part of Britain, all connected up by those famous Roman roads. And this area is certainly Romanized, to the extent that the towns have the usual Roman buildings in them, the usual Roman trappings. You have a forum where people gather to do public business. You have bathhouses, that sort of thing. And there are also quite a few large Roman villas in the south. These were huge estates run for very wealthy people, probably employing many slaves. So that part of Britain, the south and the east, this looks fairly Roman, at least if you focus on the towns and the large villas, much less in the countryside. But in the towns and villas, it looks very Roman. But there's another zone to the north and the west that looks very different. Here the landscape is hilly and rocky. It's much harder to set up the kinds of settlements the Romans are used to, and the local tribes are less cooperative. So here you need a very heavy Roman military presence. This is where we see large numbers of legions settled. In Wales, in Cornwall, in the northwest, you have to have a lot more soldiers. Here there are fortresses. They're mostly pretty successful at preventing serious revolts, but there's certainly no question that they can hold the province if they don't have soldiers. But life in a civilized part of the province is pretty good. Cities such as London, York, Lincoln, they all thrive. And it's striking, in fact, how many of the cities that are going to be important in later English history, they have Roman roots. The Romans know where to build roads. They know where to build cities, too. In the cities, the language of daily life, certainly the language of commerce, is Latin. And all of the main cultural trends in the life of the Roman Empire, they eventually make their way to Britain, sometimes a little bit late, but they get there. Artistic styles, styles of dress, even religion. From about the 3rd century, Christianity appears in Britain, and it gets a very secure foothold in the towns. Now, of course, it has plenty of competition. There are dozens of other cults being practiced in the British towns. This is the case in all Roman cities. But Roman Britain can boast a ritual center that is famous enough to draw pilgrims from other parts of the empire. And this is the settlement at Aquae Sulis. This was a town in the west of Britain that had hot springs, excellent hot springs. Now, the native British population had used the site for a long time to venerate their goddess, a goddess named Sulis. The Romans were a broad-minded sort of people. They liked to adopt the gods of the people that they conquered. So the Romans looked at the cult of this goddess Sulis, and they figured that, based on what they learned about Sulis, Sulis is pretty close to their goddess Minerva, the goddess of wisdom. And so they create a composite goddess, Sulis Minerva. And this, of course, entitles them to take advantage of the fantastic hot springs at the shrine of Sulis. And these springs later gave us our name for the city concerned, Bath. Now, some of the best Roman ruins in Britain can be found at Bath. Very elaborate pools and temple complexes, they've been beautifully excavated, and they are well worth a visit. Now, while we're talking about Bath, I just want to pause for a moment to tell you about one of my favorite kinds of archaeological artifact. There are a lot of these at Bath, and they give us a little bit of an insight into the mentality of some of the Romanized Britons who visit the site. Now, one of the reasons people come to Bath is to ask the goddess for help. Help of all kinds. I need help being cured of an illness. But one of the things that you wanted, oftentimes when you asked the goddess for help, was help getting back an object you've lost or an object that had been stolen. And so what people would do would they would write their wishes down on a tablet, and then they would throw it into the spring. And this was a way of offering your wish to the goddess. Then she'd read it clearly and then do what you wanted. And some of these tablets are really rather vicious. They're known as curse tablets. Suppose you found out that somebody actually stole your cloak, and there are actually curse tablets that talk about this. They stole your cloak, and so you want the goddess to take revenge on that person. So you actually would write on one of these wax these lead tablets, "Curse that foul wretch Publius who stole my cloak," and then you would throw it in, and then you would hope that the goddess would in fact curse Publius. Now, the people who left ritual offerings at Bath, they present a rather good cross-section of what the Romanized British population was like. There were some very rich objects that were deposited in the Springs. Doubtless, these were people who were living in the very fancy villas that I mentioned. But you also see some very humble objects. You see coins of very small value. These were clearly left by the poorer inhabitants. And the vast majority of the people who live in Roman Britain are simply poor farmers. They live on farms. They raise crops. Most of the food that they grow, they probably consume themselves. But there's a little left over for the market because they do trade in simple goods manufactured in Britain. These rural inhabitants probably speak little, if any, Latin. Their language is British. This is a Celtic language. It's not very closely related to Latin at all. Far fewer of these people who dwell in the countryside would have adopted Christianity. Most of them would have continued to follow their pagan gods throughout the period of Roman occupation. Christianity is mostly a city religion at this point. So, life in Britain carries on fairly well under Roman rule, but starting in the 3rd century, Britain begins to be attacked by barbarians. And this is a crisis that affects not just Britain, but really the whole of the Roman Empire in the 3rd century. It's a very bad century for Rome. There are various factors that cause this crisis. I'm not going to go into too much detail about this, but broadly speaking, there are 4 reasons why the Roman Empire has a bad 3rd century. There's an economic depression, and this is coupled with demographic decline. They really do go together, these 2 phenomena. People just aren't having babies because they don't feel confident in the economy, and that brings the whole economy down, so it's a downward spiral. There's also a terrible series of conflicts over the imperial succession. One thing the Romans never really figured out is how to choose the next emperor. They don't establish stable dynasties. If you know anything about the family relationships of the Roman empires, I think that will make sense. And for most of the 3rd century, there are civil wars going on throughout the Roman Empire, sometimes in more than one part of the empire at once. Finally, the enemies of Rome pick a very good time to attack. Rome faces invasions on 2 major fronts, in Eastern Europe and in the Middle East. So with all of this going on, it's not a big surprise that Britain, it's on the very edge of the empire, Britain kind of got neglected. And you can definitely see in the archaeological record that the economy of Britain contracts during this period. And Britain has its own barbarian problem, its own localized barbarian problem. Britain gets hit from 2 directions. From the west, there are raiders from Ireland. Now, these raiders from Ireland are known very confusingly as the Scotti. And this is because later on some of them are going to settle in Scotland and they will give their name to that country. But just keep in mind, the Scotti are actually coming from Ireland. And then there are also raiders from the northwest coast of Europe. These are from the Germanic-speaking tribes in what are now the Low Countries and northern Germany. And mostly they come to Britain on smash-and-grab type raids. They're looking for booty, and especially for slaves. Slaves are a huge part of the economy in this period. And these raids are a foretaste of things to come. But for the moment, the Roman Empire actually does manage to pull itself together. You get some very strong emperors emerging. They're able to reorganize the Roman army and restore the authority of the government. And one of the things they do is to try to shore up the defenses of Britain. They build new coastal defenses in the south and the east. Now, this is really quite interesting. Up until now, the Roman military effort in Britain has been concentrated in the north and the west. That's where you have the threat from the tribes who've never been completely conquered by Rome. They haven't had to worry about the south and the east. This is the most Romanized part of the province. But now, things are a little bit more unsettled out there. And these new fortresses that they build on the south and east coasts have to look out across the water. They're put under the authority of an official known as the Count of the Saxon Shore. It was called the Saxon Shore because the people they were worrying about might come from among the Saxons in northern Germany. So, the Count of the Saxon Shore is in charge of defending Britain against the barbarians from Germany. But in 367 AD, the Count is overwhelmed when Britain is hit by a perfect storm of barbarian raiders. And this episode is known as the Barbarian Conspiracy. And this is actually a contemporary term. Contemporary Roman writer named Ammianus Marcellinus called this the Barbarian Conspiracy. What seems to have happened is somehow the barbarians got together. The Irish to the west and the Picts to the north, they got together to attack Britain. At the same time, the coast of Gaul is being hit by Germanic raiders. And of course, that means that Roman authorities in Gaul can't spare any help for Britain. The Count of the Saxon Shore is killed. All seems lost until finally a large Roman army shows up. It's under the command of the future emperor Theodosius, and he saves the day. A couple of decades later, you see the same scenario repeated. Again, you have a Roman general. This is a guy named Stilicho. He comes and helps out with the latest barbarian outbreak. But that's the last time that this kind of rescue is ever going to be available to Roman Britain. And that's because things are steadily getting worse for Rome. We are headed inexorably toward the fall of Rome. In 406 AD, there's a very, very cold winter, an unusually cold winter, and the Rhine River freezes over, freezes solid, and large numbers of barbarians from the north of Europe just walk across. They walk across the river into Roman territory, and they raid all over the Roman province of Gaul. And clearly, if they're in Gaul, that's a threat to the security of Rome itself. So the emperor at the time, a guy named Honorius, he decides on a fateful step. He orders the Roman legions in Britain to withdraw to the continent. He's essentially telling the residents of Britain, you're on your own. What happens next? Here is where the picture gets a little bit murky. The traditional picture of the 5th century is that you get barbarian invasions. Without the Roman troops there to defend the province, the way lies clear for large-scale raiding. We have a rather poignant record of the reaction of the local population to this alarming turn of events, and this is preserved in a work by an author from the 6th century, a man named Gildas. I'll say more about Gildas in a moment. But he records a very plaintive request for help. The authorities in Britain apparently sent a request to the Roman commander in Gaul in the middle of the 5th century saying, please send us soldiers. And this is how the letter reads. The barbarians push us back to the sea. The sea pushes us back to the barbarians. Between these two kinds of death, we are either drowned or slaughtered. And Gildas notes that Britain gets no help in return, no answer from the Roman authorities. So that's the story that the later written sources tell us. But we as scholars have a problem. The archaeological record from the 5th century doesn't show much evidence of warfare. These records show that what you see as is not really an invasion, it's really more of a peaceful infiltration. In the early 5th century, the nature of the barbarian problem changes. Up until now, mostly we've had barbarian raids. They're going to come, grab what they want, maybe burn the rest, kill some people, take some slaves, and then leave. But starting in the middle of the 5th century, they start staying. You start to see permanent settlements in Britain, especially in the south and the east. Now, there's currently some controversy among historians about this process. It used to be thought, really following these written sources that I have just been talking about, that these settlers imposed their will by force. They're conquerors. More recently, some archaeological work has suggested that the process of Germanic settlement in Britain is really a rather gradual one, and it involves assimilation, really, more than violence. So that's some recent archaeological work. But we might be seeing the pendulum swing back the other way. And this is based on some very interesting DNA studies. And these studies seem to suggest that the DNA of native British males is suspiciously absent from the gene pool of today's English residents. There are females, no males. This would support the idea that the new settlers basically kill the native British men and marry their women. Okay? But whether it's violent or peaceful or something in between, there were probably disagreements among the people at the time about this, the new settlers put down permanent roots in Britain. They stay. They seem to have settled at first in rather small bands, perhaps no more than a few dozen people at a time. These people probably do bring their families. They bring women and children with them. There's also a lot of evidence for intermarriage, though, as I said, with the native population. And the process of assimilation seems to have taken place over several generations. Certainly, some of the British inhabitants do leave. Okay? They flee the new settlers. They move west and north and southwest.